Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
Okay, we're in the middle of Pasuk Dalet or Hey. We are going through Rashi now in the story of the binding of Isaac. We went through already the text. We went through the Ramban, Nachmanides, and now we are going through Rashi's commentary. And we are up to, I believe, Pasuk Hey, verse 5. So what we've gone through already, just as a quick review, just to get us back into the into our storyline. After these things, God tests Avraham, and Rashi had two comments on what after these things were. Rashi actually quoted from the sages that the word devarim, things, should be read as words. And he gave us two interpretations after which particular words this story is taking place after, either the words of the Satan, who claimed to God himself that Avraham really, you know, he made this whole big feast for weaning his son Yitzchak, but he didn't offer any sacrifices to you. To which God responded to the Satan, what, are you kidding me? You're starting up with my boy Avraham. My Avraham would do anything for me. He would even offer his son himself. And therefore we have this particular test. That was the first statement that we had from the sages. And the second words that Rashi quoted were the words of Yishmael, who said to Yitzchak, I don't know why everyone's making a big deal about you. I was 14 when I had my circumcision. You were 8 days old. You're a nobody. Why is everyone making a big fuss about you? To which Yitzchak responded with the words of, I'd be willing to sacrifice my whole being for God if He only asked it of me. And then God it does. And we'll try to get back to these and try to understand what exactly the sages are saying with these particular statements. We went through the rest of the commentary of God asking Avram in the three phrases of take your son, your only son, the son that you love. Rashi commented in two different places last week we saw, both in the sense as to why Hashem dragged that out, as well as why the journey had to be 3 days. The Rashi commented, as we had seen in the Ramban as well, not to addle him, that he should be clear, he should be concise, he should know what's going on, so that since this is going to be such a major episode in Jewish history, and it should be done with sound body and sound mind, and no one should ever say, well, Avram was startled by God, and he was like, oh, okay, whatever you say, but he didn't really have a chance to think it through, so that every step of the way, Rashi and the Ramban commented where things were set up in a way where Avram would have a chance to think about it. Rashi also commented to increase his reward, that he wouldn't know where he was going, just to one of the mountains. He didn't know exactly where. So there was the element of just sort of following after God and not knowing exactly where he would go. Okay, let us, that was just a brief summary. Let us get to verse 4 and 5 and pick it up. So let's pick up verse 4 again. Vayom HaShlishi, it's the third day. Avram is out on his journey. Vayisah Avraham as Einav. He lifts up his eyes. Vayaras Hamakom Me'rachok. And he saw it from far away. And this was the last thing that we had seen last week. Rashi comments in the bottom of verse 4. He saw the place. He saw a cloud affixed to the mountain. What do you mean he saw the place? God said, I'm going to show you the place. And we don't have any conversation. So how do you know which place it was? So Rashi here quotes from the sages that there was a cloud of glory above that particular mountain. And what Rashi here does not quote, but what the sages do say, Rashi then has a conversation with his, Avram has a conversation with his son Yitzchak, and he says, Yitzchak, do you see what I see over there? And Yitzchak says, yeah, sure, I see that cloud. And he says, Avram then turns to his two lads that were with him and asks them, do you see what we see over there? And they say, well, we don't see anything. So he says, okay, fine, you guys stay here with the donkey. Just like the donkey doesn't see the cloud, you'll stay here with him, and we're going to continue forward and do that which we need to do, which is our next verse over here in verse 5. Let's pick up with this. Avram said to his two lads, two young men who were with him, Shvu lochem po im hachamor, you stay here with the donkey. Vani vanar nilcho ad ko. And I and the lad will go up to here. Now Rashi is going to discuss the word ad ko. Ko, like the, until here, as if you're pointing to a place that normally would be used like right here in front of you. And Avram is using it in a sense of, we are going to go ad ko, until here, which really is the wrong word. You'd say we're going to go until there, or we're going to stop here. But he's mixing them up, saying we're going to go until we get here, which is a obviously not the correct use, which is where Rashi is going to pick up on. But that's the statement that Avraham makes to his lad. You stay here with the donkey. I and Yitzchak, we are going off to here. We're going to that place. We will worship, literally prostrate ourselves, bow down. And then we will return to you. Okay, says Rashi, ad ko, up to here, kiloma, that is to say, a short way. Meaning Rashi is addressing the usage, as I mentioned. What do you mean, until here? That isn't the correct way of speaking. So he says, on the simple meaning, it means, in a short way. It's going to be, it's not so far away before we have to continue travel until we get to the place that we need to go, to the place which lies right before us. That would be the simple interpretation. Then Rashi quotes the Medrash. The Agadic Midrash interprets it as follows. The word ko was used elsewhere. Ko was used when Hashem comes down to Avram and promises him, without any children, getting on in age, and he says, you will have children. They will be as numerous as the stars. He says, ko yezarecha. He takes him outside his tent, and he shows him the stars in the heaven, and he says, ko yezarecha. Like these stars are your children going to be. So says the Medrash, Avram is picking up on that word when he says to his lad, he says, Yitzchak and I are going ad, where are we going to? Ko. He's picking up on the prophecy that he'd been given, that says, I've been given a prophecy that says my children are going to be as numerous as the stars. With that same word of ko yezarecha, just like this will your children be. And now I have a prophecy of take the child who is going to carry that out and slaughter him. So I'm going to see ad ko. I'm going to, so to speak, check out this prophecy. See how Rashi says it? The Agadic Midrash interprets it as follows. I will see where is that which the omnipresent one said to me, so shall your offspring be. I'm going to that place to see like what's going to be the place where he said to me, your children will be as numerous as the stars, and now I'm going to that place with a prophecy to slaughter him, and that's where I'm going to check that out, so to speak, to see what's going to become. And Rashi's going to get back to this shortly in another more lengthy comment discussing it. Yeah?
Okay, so that makes sense to me, because God has told Abraham he has a special destiny,
mm-hmm.
and he's head of the Jewish people,
uh-huh.
and now we are at high noon.
Right.
Now we're at high noon. I don't know what this is going to look like, and really, it looks like the end,
mm-hmm.
but I'm ready to go there.
Right, it sounds like you're following up on what we've seen in the language of Hineni. Here I am, I'm ready. I don't get it. I don't know what this is going to look like, and I don't know how this is going to work out, but that's my job is, this is what you asked, and this is what I'm therefore going to do, and I'm going to find out. I'm going to the place where he told me, Ko Yezarecha. I'm going there to slaughter my son upon whom he said that blessing, and that's where I'm going, and I'm referencing the prophecy of Ko Yezarecha, so will your children be as numerous as the stars, as I take that child on the way to fulfill that. Then Avram is tying those two prophecies together with this phrase of, you stay here, and we're going ad ko. We're going to that same word that was used to begin the prophecy of many children. Vinashuv, and we will return. And when we learned through the text, we were bothered by this phrase. Because Avram knows what he's going to do. He's going to slaughter his son. Why does he say to the two lads that we will return? So Rashi here comments something which he does in other places throughout the Torah as well. He says, in Nisnavi, he prophesied that both of them would return. And you have this idea where you often find, Rashi will comment, that biblical characters who are involved in prophecy will say things, as even though they weren't saying it to be prophetic, they weren't saying it as a prophet, but their words are prophetic. That somehow, the way that Hashem creates the words that come to their mind, they use words which do in fact foreshadow that which will take place. And Rashi here comments, this example which we were bothered by, just on a textual level, why would Avram choose the words, we will return, when he doesn't have any intention of doing that? He has the intention of, I will return. So we might have suggested, somebody might have wanted, he didn't want to tip off Yitzchak, or he didn't want to tip off the lads. Maybe on a simple level we could have said something like that, that he wanted to just, clothe it in nothing going on, nothing suspicious. And if he would say I, then they would say, like, what do you mean I? What about the, where's Yitzchak? But Rashi comments that this was an example where biblical figures are sometimes prophetic without even necessarily attempting or knowing it, but that the words that come out of their mouth, in fact, end up being prophetic. Okay, moving on to 234, make sure you have the right side of the page. Verse 6, top of the page. Vayikach Avraham es atzei ha'ola. Avram took the wood for the offering. Remember, he chopped the wood back at his home before the journey, as the Ramban had commented. He didn't want to take any chance that he would get there and would not have everything that he needed, so he chopped the wood already back. Now he's leaving the donkey behind, so now he has to take the wood himself. What does he do with the wood that he took? Vayosem al Yitzchak bino. He places it on top of his son Yitzchak. Vayikach biyado es ha'ish va'asa ma'achelet. And then he takes in his hand the fire and the knife. Vayelchu shnehem yachtov. And the two of them went together. So the Torah sets up the scene of the donkey being left behind. Avram taking the wood. We're like told in graphic detail. Avraham takes the wood off of the donkey, places it on top of Yitzchak. We reference again, if you remember, the story of the expulsion of Yishmael, where there also we had Avraham sending away Yishmael, and then Hagar taking Yishmael and placing him on her shoulders. And here we have Yitzchak placing the wood on his shoulder back, however he carried it. I don't know if he carried it in his hands. It sounds like it was placed more on his back and he schlepped it. Something along those lines. Somebody else? Yeah.
So it was actually like placing it for him to carry. It wasn't like actually binding it.
Right, because they still have a journey ahead of them. They're not yet at on the place of the mountain, so it sounds like it was for him to carry. Which is of note, just the fact we're told this. Like, who cares? In other words, what would have been missing? Again, this is a question you'd like to ask yourselves when you're learning the Chumash, and you're learning it what would have been if the Torah would have said, Avram left the lad and the donkey behind, and he got to the place, why do I need to know back here already what's being added? That he took the wood off of the donkey and he placed it on Yitzchak and he takes the fire and the knife in his hand. We're given a lot of details, so right now we're just sort of setting up that, pointing that out. Somebody else also pointed out, which I just want to repeat as well, I believe when they left in verse 2, and we take a look at all the things that Avram originally, verse 3, all the things that he took with him, on page 232, verse 3, Avraham arose early in the morning, he saddled his donkey, took his two young men with him and Isaac, his son, split the wood for the offering, stood up and went to the place of which God had spoken to him. So both the fire and the knife are left off of the list. The wood we're told about. We're told that he split the wood back in his home in verse 3, that he took it with him. And then here in verse 6, when he leaves the donkey behind, he's taking the wood that he had chopped and placing it on his son Yitzchak. And then the knife and the fire, which apparently we did not need to be told about in verse 3, when he's gathering all those things to go, we are told that he clearly did take them, and now he's taking them with him in verse 6. Okay, now the knife in the language of the Chumash is called the ma'acheles. It's not called a sakin, a knife, it's called a ma'acheles. Ma'acheles means causes to eat, would be the most literal translation of ma'acheles. So Rashi here comments, the knife. A knife is called a ma'acheles, from the word to eat, because it eats the flesh that it cuts. First interpretation, why would the Torah call a knife a ma'acheles? Because as you cut through something, it's as if you are devouring that which you are cutting. You're taking that which was whole and slicing it up. So that therefore the knife is called a machalos because it devours, it eats that which it cuts, the flesh that it cuts into. As the verse says, and the sword shall eat flesh. So you see the pasuk in the Devarim uses that language of a knife, so to speak, eating the flesh that it cuts into.
Do we have any example today of what kind of knife that would be?
I have no idea. I would just imagine some type of knife that would be valid for a ritual slaughter. But other than that,
I'm thinking even if you had like a paring knife and you were going to eat an apple, you're still going to cut the flesh of the apple with the knife and devour it so you can eat it. I mean, it doesn't have to be like an animal or a...
Correct. So in other words, the first interpretation is saying, it's in a general term, a knife is called a ma'achelos because it devours whatever it is that it's cutting. And the second interpretation we'll do in a second is much more specific to ritual slaughter. Dover Acher, alternatively, this one is called a ma'achelos because, I skipped a line. At the end of the first paragraph is the second interpretation. And a knife is called a machalos because it prepares the flesh for eating. Meaning the first interpretation was a knife just devours whatever it cuts. So it's called a machalos because it eats. Second interpretation of the Rashi quotes why it's called a machalos is because it prepares flesh for us to eat, which would be much more in the sense of a ritual slaughtering type knife that will prepare food for us. And then he brings a third interpretation. Alternatively, this one is called a ma'acheles because Israel eats of its reward. This is the more agadic interpretation. In other words, because of what Avram is about to do with this knife and the reward which will stand in his children's stead for generations, so then the knife is already sort of foreshadowed in the Torah as a ma'acheles. It gives to eat in that it gives us, his descendants, what to eat because of his actions. So you see just an interesting thing here, just I want to just point out in this Rashi. What Rashi here is doing is the Torah uses a unusual word for a very usual object. He took a knife. We have words in the Chumash and the Torah for a knife. And instead of using those words, the Torah instead uses like a new word, a ma'acheles, from the root of the word to eat. So Rashi is about, like, what's this word doing here? And you see what he's doing. He takes you through the various levels of, oh, it just means a knife is called a machal, because a knife eats up whatever it cuts. Versus, you know, here specifically the Torah calls it a machal, because it's a type of knife which prepares food for us to eat. It's a ritual slaughterer type knife. And then he has the most agadic interpretation of, it's a machal, because it will serve us not food, but in reward for the action that Avram is about to do with it, and you just see the different levels that Rashi's working through, what he saw in the usage of the word ma'achalas here.
So when it talks about its reward, it's the knife.
Its reward, meaning...
Like the knife is going to give us... Like the knife,
so to speak, right.
Used,
right.
That's why the special
correct.
Word for knife.
Yeah. Okay, Vayelchu Shneihem Yachdav, the two of them went together. So the Torah gives us the scene. Avram takes all of these items, the knife, the fire, the wood, and then the two of them go together, says Rashi. Now, if you recall, again, we've seen the text already, so we can foreshadow. This phrase is going to appear again in the next verse. Two verses later, we're going to have that same phrase of Vayelchu Shneihem Yachdav. We have also pointed out, and I'll repeat again here, this is the first verb in our story. We're now in verse 6, that is plural. Right? Every verb until this point has been, this is Avraham's story. Avraham is the one being spoken to. Every action that has taken place is a singular verb. Even when they depart, in the end of verse 3, we pointed out, he split the wood, he stood up, and he went to the place that God told him. And the verb there is Vayelech. And he went to the place that God had told him. So even though Avram is leaving with an entourage of his son Yitzchak and two other lads, who's going? Avram's going. Every verb has been singular, and now we get to this place of Avram, again, beginning of verse 6, Vayikach Avram, he takes the wood, he places it on Yitzchak, he takes the fire, he takes the knife, and they go together. Says Rashi, Vayelchu Shneihem Yachtov, and the two of them went together. Avraham, who was aware that he was going to slaughter his son, was going with the same eagerness and joy as Yitzchak, who was unaware of the matter. And the fact that the Torah stresses they're going together, of course they're going, what do you mean they're going together? They're going together in the same emotional state. Avraham, Yitzchak is totally unaware of what's coming. Yitzchak is unaware of what's coming, and Avram, who knows what he's about to do, has the same ratzon and simcha, Rashi says, the same willingness, the same joy about what he's about to perform as Yitzchak, who doesn't even know what it is that's coming. Now, verse 7, interestingly, which we're going to focus on a lot later, Rashi here has nothing to comment on. But verse 7, just to read it, because it's a critical verse in our story. Vayomer Yitzchok el Avram aviv, and Yitzchok then says to Avram his father, Vayomer, what does he say to Avram his father? Avi. He says, Father. Vayomer hineni bini. And Avram responds, yes, here I am, my son. Vayomer. Yitzchok then says, Hine ho esh veho etzim, I see that you have taken in your hand the fire and the wood. What did he not mention?
What is the offering?
No, the knife.
Oh, no,
the knife. Right? The pasuk in verse 6 made a big deal of three things. That Avram took the wood and placed it on Yitzchok, and then he took in his hand the knife and the fire. And now, when Yitzchok says to his dad, hey dad, he says, yes son, I'm here. Well, I says, I see we have the fire and the wood. Ayei hasel li'olah. Where is the lamb? Because it seems like that's what we're doing. Why does Yitzchak not mention the knife? I don't know. But we're still asking questions, so it's okay.
Well, if you're going to build a fire, do you necessarily cut the food before you cook it? I guess maybe you have to kill it rather than capture it. I don't know how you do that. Like if you're going to sacrifice an animal, do you burn it up whole or do you cut it first?
Some different types of sacrifices are done differently. But you're saying, but the bottom line is Avram took the knife, right?
Well, no, of course he took it, but I'm saying maybe Yitzchak wouldn't be asking about the knife because he doesn't perceive the knife's being used immediately. Like, you're going to find a lamb.
Oh, you just burn it whole?
I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, they always would slaughter at first, yeah. Even the animals that are burnt whole,
they slaughter. They
are slaughtered first, and then the rest of the animal is burnt whole, yeah.
Okay.
So it's of note. And I this is why I love constantly learning. However, we've already been through this several times ourselves. We did the text, we did the Ramban. And as I was saying that right now, I was like, hey, where's the knife? Like each time you do it, you notice different things. Why is the knife missing? I don't know. I just noticed that myself right now as we were going through this. But we'll see what we can come with. Rashi does not comment on this verse at all. This is Yitzchak's only speaking part in this entire story. Yitzchak is not going to say anything throughout the rest of the story. And this is his only part. Avi, he says, Dad. Avram responds, yes, my son. And Yitzchak says, I see the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for the offering? So far, so good?
Mm-hmm.
Let's move on. 8. Vayomer Avraham Elokim Yirelo Haseli Ola Bini. Avraham responds and says, God will see for himself, Yirelo, will see for himself the lamb for his offering, my son. Vayolchu Shnehem Yachtav. And here we have that phrase again, and the two of them went together in their travels. Says Rashi, what is this response of Avraham, which is an interesting response. Avraham, right, what's Yitzchak looking for in this response? Avraham to say, oh, the kid is up on the mountaintop already, or I don't know what he's looking for. And Avraham says, God will see for himself the lamb for an offering, my son. Now you'll notice the comma in the English after the word offering. Right, God will see the lamb for himself for the offering, comma, my son. Now, if you wouldn't put a comma there, and you'd put either a colon or, let's say, a dash,
right,
it would read very differently, right? It would read, God will see the lamb for himself for the offering, my son. Now, the translation with the comma there is correct. That's the simple meaning. And Rashi's going to tell us, however, that embedded within Avram's response, he worded it in a way which would allow for the other meaning as well. It says Rashi, God will see the lamb for himself, Kloma, that is to say, he will see and select for himself the lamb. He will choose. He didn't ask me to take a lamb. God will choose the lamb. And if it so happens, Avram says to his son, that there is no lamb, Li'ola b'ni, for the offering, my son, then is the back half of Avram's words, then you, my son, become the offering. And even though Afal Pi Shehaven Yitzchak understood from Avram's words that he was going to be slaughtered, The Torah then concludes with the same phrase of Yilchu Shnehem Yachdav. The two of them went together, implying with an equal heart, with the same enthusiasm. As we saw from the first phrase, where Avraham was going, and Yitzchak did not know what was going on, and yet they traveled the same. And there, the fact that they traveled the same, when you look at that first Vayelchu Shnehem Yachdav, they both were traveling together. Was it a big deal that Yitzchak was traveling with joy and willingness there? No, because he thinks that he's just on a mission to serve God. And he's happy to do that. There, the fact that Avram was able to do so, and that Avram was able to go with the same joy and willingness as his son Yitzchak, that was the testimony to Avram's greatness. And now, two verses later, when they're traveling together, now Avram knows what's going on still, but now Yitzchak is now brought on into the story. And he still travels with the same ratzon and simcha, the same joy and the same willingness that he had had previously before he knew. And now you have the two of them continuing to travel together up the top of this mountain. Yitzchak schlepping the wood on his back that's going to be used in his own sacrifice, and Avram, who is supposed to be the one to perform that sacrifice.
Okay, question.
Yeah.
Now, Rashi goes into detail about dialogue going back and forth among characters.
Mm-hmm.
So why is there, when Avram rises early in the morning, splits the wood, he saddles the donkey and what have you, and then they start on their journey, I don't see any dialogue of either the young man or Isaac saying, "Hey, Dad, where are we going?"
Correct. We don't have anything. You're right.
But I guess my point is, if Rashi is seeing dialogue between Satan and God, and then later we have this dialogue, I'm wondering why there is no comment or no thought about, why isn't someone asking, where are we going?
It's a fair question. Rashi is really basing himself on the Medrash, on the statement of the sages. So he has, I don't know the answer to your question, I can look it up for you, but right now I don't know the answer. Whether or not the sages themselves did not see any of the hints in the text to the dialogue earlier, or the Rashi just didn't choose to quote it in his commentary. So I don't know if it's not there, or if Rashi just decided that he wasn't interested for whatever reason, and in terms of how he wrote his commentary, he's a digest of the Medrash. He doesn't quote everything, why he didn't see necessary to bring in that dialogue. But it's certainly, you are correct and accurate in your insight that we don't have any dialogue when they took off, who was thinking what. Other than it seemed clear they were going to perform some sacrifice, because, I mean, Avram's chopping wood. He must have taken a knife in the fire, even though we're not told that, but clearly he has it there, because in verse 6 he takes it off the donkey and brings it with him. So they had to have known that they were going on some sort of a sacrificing mission. We will get back to when we go through, as I have committed to do, some of Rabbi David Forman's approach to this particular story. So he will pick up on the word Ayeh Haseli Olah. When Yitzchak asks, where is the lamb, he uses the word Ayeh. And for those of you who were at my Adam and Eve story, the Garden of Eden story, when God asks Adam, the first man, he says, Ayeka, he says, where are you? So there are two words in Hebrew to ask the question, like, where are you, or where is something? What are the two words, anyone know?
Epho
is one, and Ayeka, or Ayeh, is the other. Epho is always used when you want to know the coordinates of something. Like, where is it? Where are my brothers? I'm looking for them. I don't know where they are. Epho heim lohim. Where can I find them? Ayeh or Ayeka is a question where I'm asking, but there is no real answer. I'm not asking for coordinates. When God asks Adam, where are you? He's not asking, like, which bush are you hiding behind? He's saying, what happened to you? Where are you? It's not a question of, like, just where is it, but where has it gone? It's not in the place where it should be. It's a much more existential type of question of where. Ayeh Dagon V'Tirosh, a child that Navi describes in the time of the destruction, where is the bread? He knows it's not the cover. He's not asking, like, where can I find it? But, like, what's happened to us that there is nothing to be eaten? And Yitzchak here asks, Ayeh Haseli Olah. He's not asking using a word of you know, this isn't like, just where is it? It's asking a much more existential, like, I see it's not here. Where is that sound? We'll talk more about that. But in terms of, in your response, you're like, where is the dialogue? So I don't know what they were thinking along the way, but as the Torah is giving us a hint as they're getting closer, that Yitzchak is clearly aware that something is not the way that it should be if all they were doing was going to be to worship and then to return, like Avram said, hey Dad, where's the Seth? That's what we're doing. And it's a question of, and I know that it's not, you're not going to tell me it's up at the top, because then I would have said Afo. I know that there's something up as far as the words that I choose. But yeah, we'll talk more about that later. Okay, 9. So they arrive now at the place of which God had told Abraham to go to, and flip to top of 235. Abraham constructs, he builds an altar. Really, he built the altar, as we saw already. The Ramban pointed out this was the specific altar that had been, right? The Ramban, if you recall, traced this altar back from Adam Harishon, the first man who used this as an altar, and then Noah. So he traced this this specific altar. Vayaroch aso etzim. He arranged the wood. Vayakod es Yitzchak bino. He bound Isaac his son. Vayosem oso al hamizbeach mimaal lo etzim. And he placed them on the altar atop the wood. Anyone remember the question we asked on this verse? There was an order question that we were bothered by.
And then it says, don't stretch out your hands.
No, in verse 9.
He built the altar and arranged the wood. He bound Isaac his son. And placed him on the altar.
I'll set you up with a question. If I told you that this story was called The Binding of Isaac, how would you conjure up in your mind, what does it mean, the binding, what did it look like, the binding of Isaac? Just that phrase.
Seems like you're putting the wood around him.
And how would you have done it?
With leather. With ropes.
With leather ropes.
Tied him with ropes to the wood?
No.
Just tied his hands.
Tied him.
Or tied his hands to his body somehow. Or
tie him up, he could flip over. He can flip over and get away.
So
would you tie him up with wood? You tie him up with wood. And also the Goyim use this story for their own purposes.
Okay.
Binding someone to a piece of wood.
Okay. So now we'll read the story carefully and you'll see that's not what happens. Okay. Avram builds the altar and arranges the wood.
I'm just thinking of how heavy a grown man is when you have to schlep him himself.
Then he binds Isaac, and he placed him on the altar atop the wood.
How does he bind him?
It's clear that Yitzchak is not being bound to the wood that's been arranged. Like in my head, I would have said, like, what does it mean? I mean, he had an altar, he put the wood which is going to burn, and then he would bind Isaac to that wood for the binding of Isaac as to be offered as a sacrifice. But whether you would have thought that or not, that's not what's clearly happening here is that the wood is arranged. Isaac is bound, and then a bound Isaac is placed atop the wood. Let's take a look at Rashi. Vayakod, and he bound. He bound Isaac's hands and feet me'achorov behind him. Hayadayim v'raglayim v'yach. The tying of the hands and feet together is called binding. So when you tie hands behind him, he tied his hands together and his feet together, that is called an akedah. That's called binding. So the binding of Yitzchak is really totally separate from the altar and the wood. The binding of Yitzchak is as he's standing off to the side, he ties his hands behind him, he ties his feet together, and that is the phrase that we refer to as the binding of Yitzchak, which I have to just comment. I find fascinating when you learn through this Rashi, and you see that it's clear in the text that that's what happened. We refer to this entire episode as Akedas Yitzchak. The whole episode is referred to as the binding of Yitzchak. When you stop and think about it, I think that's an interesting way that Chazal, our sages, define this episode. I would not have defined it. I would have said the binding of Isaac is the most inconsequential side point of the story. What is this story about? That Avram is ready and willing to take his son, not knowing how this makes any sense whatsoever, and is ready to offer him as a sacrifice. The fact that Yitzchak was bound beforehand is a detail in the story. Yeah?
Is there any other translation for the word, the Hebrew word bound or bind? Can it mean something like he committed his son to this endeavor?
I don't think so. Rashi is clearly stressing that Akedah is the physical binding, and that represents our story, which is an interesting point. Now, maybe I was too harsh to think it was completely inconsequential, but to say that defines this story, that he bound Yitzchak up, and we have a lot of things in these stories. We have a lot of material to go through as we've been learning this, and to point out and say this act is the way the sages will define and refer to this story as Akedos Yitzchak, the binding of Yitzchak. Because as he was standing there off to the side, he tied his hands, he tied his feet, and then he placed them on top. But what's the whole story about? He tied his hands and he tied his feet together. It's a very interesting point that we give such a stress to that. Not that it's inconsequential, but that I wouldn't have defined the story by it. But you disagree with me.
Yeah, because there's a big difference between binding and tying up an animal and tying up a person.
Okay.
And Yitzchak is supposed to be a grown man at this point, meaning that he's going to have to go along with it.
Okay.
So if you go
with that interpretation, you're now shifting the story from Avraham's story to Yitzchak's story. So that if we say Akedos Yitzchak, the binding of Yitzchak, we are focusing on the role that Yitzchak has in the story. I don't know that we're going to find that runs true when Chazal refer to this as being Yitzchak's big test in as much as it is Avraham's test. It's one of the 10 tests of Abraham, not one of the 10 tests of Yitzchak. So to say that the reason why we refer to it as the binding of Yitzchak is because of Yitzchak's role is an interesting thing to define the act as something which moves it away from the big trial. It's Abraham's trial, not Yitzchak's.
It's going to be a defining moment in Yitzchak's life that's mentioned in Chazal over and over again.
I know, but it's Abraham's test.
Right.
You're right, but it's Avram. We're going to see this is going to have a major aspect of Yitzchak's life for the rest of his life. There's no question. But we're defining Avram's test. In other words, I'll add that to our question. In order for Avram to bind Yitzchak, let's just restate that. What has to have happened?
Cooperation.
Right? Yitzchak had to have said, okay, he had to have placed his hands behind his back, he had to have kept his feet there, and he had to have not run away, right? That's clear.
Right.
So why are we now defining Avraham's test by a phrase which is not Avraham's action in as much as it is Yitzchak's action? I just wouldn't have called this, what are the sages getting at when they define this by Akedus Yitzchak, the binding of Yitzchak? They should define it as the Vayishlach as Yodo Yitzchak, he's sending forth his hand. That defines the act, but just a comment as to
define. But treating Yitzchak as an Ola, this is his son and he is human, and now he's tying him up the way you would tie up an animal before you sacrifice.
That's fine, but so then out of all the actions that he did, from the time that he traveled to the time that he sent out, that's the biggest one, the tying it up, not the taking out the knife. It's just interesting that we would say, like, that is the defining moment. Yeah.
Using 21st century experience and analogy, I wouldn't think that Isaac would be so willing to be bound. I would think that there could have been a struggle. And that's part of the test. That's part of the...
Okay, we don't see that anywhere in the text, nor in what the sages see. And it's hard to imagine had there been a struggle between a 37-year-old Yitzchak and a 137-year-old Avram, that Avram would win that struggle.
But it just doesn't seem so easy for Abraham to do.
Right. Mentally and emotionally, but not necessarily physically. It's just hard. I mean, we're not told anything, but it's hard to imagine that Avraham, 100 years older than his son Yitzchak, would win a battle of being able to bind him up if Yitzchak really didn't want it. It just, I mean, it could be. It's just hard to imagine.
All right. Well, with your question of why is it called binding of Isaac, it couldn't be called the sacrificing of Isaac, because Isaac didn't get sacrificed.
Mm. Okay. Mm.
And this is as close as Abraham came.
So I'll tell you this.
The actual sacrifice.
Even with that point, would you rather call it the binding of Isaac or then the placing of Isaac on the altar? Which one more gets closer to what you're trying to get at?
This is shorter and gets...
So another, right?
More words.
Even so, that would be my point. In other words, even if you wanted to go with what you're saying... So which action gets closest to what he did? The binding, the placing, the stretching forth of the knife? So was it just because it's the easiest? Is that what we're going to come down to?
The binding is the first time he actually touched Isaac.
Okay.
In order to do what he...
Fine. That'll be fine. My point is to bring up the point. That's a fair answer, that it's simply, you know, it's the first, you know, even though he put the wood on him and had the travel, but that's the first... action of dealing with him as a sacrifice. Okay, that would be an answer. That, therefore, all it represents is that, the first action. Yeah.
Going back to where the lads that he came with did not see the cloud.
Right.
If Isaac saw the cloud,
mm-hmm.
then he knew he was walking towards God and mm-hmm. that this mission was more than just a walk in nature.
Yeah.
And so... if his father said, put your hand, this speaks to what you were saying, is that there was no struggle listed here. Then he knew, if he saw the cloud, he knew he was part of a holy mission, so to speak. And so he was willing to be bound. He was willing to get on the altar. He was willing to help his father.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I would just deduce.
And that's right. I'd like to take a look at a commentary when we finish also, as we just tie this up, that points out specifically when Avraham tells Yitzchak this is what the commandment is, so Avraham has the status of an established prophet.
Yeah.
So that Yitzchak receives this command from the mouth of an established prophet. So that's, you know, Yitzchak listened to many things. Yitzchak, you know, would go through a circumcision to his son, because that's what Avram said to do. But when the test is for Avram to receive this prophecy and interpret it correctly, but your point is correct, that Yitzchak receives the prophecy from an established prophet, Avram receives a prophecy from Hashem and has to see it clearly that is exactly what Hashem wants him to do, even though it doesn't make any sense. Okay, I want to just finish with Rashi, because Rashi has an interesting phrase on the word Akedah, the binding, says it's also related to the word Akudim, the ringed ones. They're referring to the different sheep and cattle, sheep and lamb that Yaakov had when he was working for his uncle Lavan. He had the spotted and the ringed sheep, and they were called Akudim, which is the same word of Akedah. Rashi says, why does the ringed sheep share a word with to be bound as a sacrifice? So Rashi comments that the ringed goats are referred to by a term connoting binding, for their ankles were white, the place where people would normally bind it. And therefore it was noticeable. Because the word rings comes when you bind an animal, so then the skin underneath the area where it's being bound turns white because of the pressure from the rope. So that the word for ringed became the same derivative of the word for binding, because binding something causes white rings on the skin. And therefore Rashi says that's how the etymology of a word develops, in terms of the same word for ringed as for being bound, because of that which is caused. Okay, so in any case, so we have this verse. Avram builds the altar, he arranges the wood, then he binds up his son Yitzchak, places Yitzchak, who is now already bound, atop of the wood. Verse 10, Vayishlach Avraham et yado. Avram then sends forth, stretches out his hand, Vayikach es hamachalas, and he takes the knife, Lishchot es vino, to slaughter his son. Now Rashi again does not comment here, even though this is this dramatic climax of our story in which Avraham is now sending forth his hand. We pointed out Vayishlach Avraham as Yodor is a word that we saw in the story of Hagar and Yishmael as well. There Avraham was sending forth Yishmael from his house. And then when Hagar sees that Yishmael is going to die of thirst, also we have the phrase of Vayishlach as when she sends forth, she throws off, so to speak, her son that he should die and she shouldn't see it. And here we have that same verb again, Avram sending forth his hand now to do the same to his son. The whole phrase is a little bit extraneous. Think about what this is being said out here in English. Right, we never would say this. If we were talking in English, you wouldn't say this. Where is the knife right now before the verse? Like, I don't know, is it in his pocket, is it on the floor, I don't know, wherever it is. So what should the verse say? He took the knife.
And then stretched out. Right.
Right? If we would say he stretched out his hand afterwards, then it would be the idea of, then that would be our Alfred Hitchcock image of, you know, like the knife. That's not what it says. He stretched out his hand, not with the knife in his hand over his son. It's that he's stretching forth his hand to take the knife to slaughter his son. Which is not the image we have of Avram standing over his son with the knife in his hand outstretched. That's not what we have. We have him. But why is that phrase necessary at all? He stretched out his hand to take the knife. What's with?
Where was the knife? Does that have to do with some parallel to Moses having God put the staff in his hand later?
So we're going to have to find what it has to do with. I don't know if it's necessarily that, but the whole phrase, it's just an odd phrase. It's clearly here to tell us something, to find out what, that he's stretching forth his hand just to grab it. Just tell me, he took the knife. And if you want to tell me the phrase, he stretched forth his hand, tell me afterwards. Now, that would then mean, with the knife in his hand, he stretched out his hand to slaughter his son. But this verse just says he stretched forth his hand to take the knife to slaughter his son.
It's translated, and took the knife. Is it not accurate?
That's correct. Vayishlach, I mean, he stretched forth his hand, vayikachas hamachelas, to slaughter his son. Correct. But we don't have the image of Avram then raising the knife over his son Yitzchak's throat. That's not described in this particular verse, because the stretching forth of the hand was just to grab the knife. And then the Torah, in my mind, what seems to be another extraneous phrase, which I'd like to explore as well, the phrase of the back phrase of Lishchot Ez Beno, to slaughter his son, which also would seem to be unnecessary at this point in our story. But the Torah goes out of its way to tell us that as well, that when he stretched out his hand, he took the knife, and the reason why he took the knife was to slaughter his son, with being repeating that again. In any case, Rashi does not comment on that verse 10, leaving us with verse 11, Vayikroi lov maloch Hashem in Hashamayim, and an angel of Hashem calls to Avram from heaven, Vayomer, Avraham, Avraham, calling out twice, Vayomer, Hineini. So we mentioned, we had three questions on this verse. Number one, how do we address the fact that it's only an angel calling out to Avram and not God himself? God himself is the one who appeared to Avram to give him the original command, and here we have an angel coming to eventually rescind the command. Number two, he calls out twice, as opposed to how many times did God call out in the beginning? Only once. He says, Avram. And we pointed out that this is the third Hineni in our story. Avram responds Hineni to God in the original request. Avram responds Hineni to his son Yitzhak Isaac, and now Avram responds Hineni to the angel calling out. We'll do one little Rashi. We'll have to leave in this moment. Avram Lashon Chibo is an expression of endearment when one repeats someone's name. So just to call out once is to get their attention. To call out twice, as Rashi, is expressing more than just that, but expressing a term of endearment. Okay, we almost got through it. We have at least one more day, and then we'll continue on.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.